I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Tank Slappers podcast, Autosport and the Motorsport Network's podcast for all things two-wheeled. I am your host, Lewis Duncan, and joining me as ever is Oriol Puigdemont and Yuri. It's a special episode because I'm led to believe it's our 50th Tank Slappers podcast, so yep. Martin tells me, so...
Half century.
Yeah, it's incredible to think where we started in that when we borrowed a classroom at Silverstone last year. To where we are now.
Yeah, a long time ago, and a lot of things have happened.
Feels like a lifetime ago. Well, this is our season review podcast. You know, as a nice Christmas treat for the listeners, I suppose as well. Let's go back to July, which feels like another lifetime ago.
Yeah.
Into the Spanish Grand Prix, everything that happened in that race: Marquez crashing and injuring himself, Quartararo winning, Yamaha engine problems. So much of what happened in the championship afterwards, all the storylines really are linked to that Spanish Grand Prix.
Yeah, I would say that the only thing not related was the Mir crashing.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think it was one of the, I would say, the key Grand Prix of the year, because we had Marquez crash after a brutal recovery. And yeah, the thing is that we never know what would have happened without this crash.
In a parallel universe somewhere, there's a championship where Marquez was not injured, but he was, and he never came back. He tried to make this recovery a week later, which you wrote a few weeks ago. That was really the biggest mistake that Marquez made from that whole Spanish Grand Prix, was trying to come back so soon. He was influenced by the doctors. He was told that he was fine to go racing, but there should have been more restraint there from both maybe Mark and from Honda.
Well, I think in the end, it's not that, I don't know, you know, but there's a lot of, I would say, let's say secret, not, I wouldn't say secret, but it's very close, it's very hermetic, all related to this crash and the following days. But I would say that probably the doctors didn't, they were not so clear, or forbid Mark to jump into the bike, which was probably the main problem. I wouldn't say, of course, he has the main responsibility because he is the one jumping into the bike, but at the same time he followed, I wouldn't say advices, but if the doctor said no, he wouldn't have jumped into the bike. That's clear. So there's something there. I think that there was a bit of a discussion between the doctors. Few doctors said, okay, you can try, and some others said, better not. And in the end, you have to know that if you allow a rider like Marc Márquez you give him just a tiny, tiny, tiny spark of hope, he will try it. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
And to be fair to Honda, it's worth pointing out that they didn't want him to race, really. They'd packed up, they said, okay, you can come back, but let's try on the Saturday, and if you're too bad, let's park it. And that's what Mark did. But I think what it showed was just how much pressure there was on the riders in this short calendar. Mark obviously knew that you lose one race, you lose two races, that's a big, big dent to your championship hopes. And we saw that in bits across the season, riders making mistakes and trying to come back as soon as possible. And
yeah, but the thing is that we know that afterwards, you know. I mean, yeah. it's very easy now that the championship is over and that we have, I mean, the Mir won the championship, but very a small amount of points. So now it's very easy to say Mark should have been away for 3-4 races, and he could have still be able to win the title, to win the title. But now we know that. Yeah. At that point,
yeah,
we didn't know that. So
yeah,
maybe he thought, whoa, if I miss 3 races, Dobby will get 3 wins in a row. I don't know. You know what I mean? Or Suzuki, or maybe Maverick, or even Fabio. Don't forget, after Jerez 2 and Jerez 1 and Jerez 2, we thought, whoa, Fabio's going to win the title. Easy.
Yeah. After Jerez, Mark's worst nightmare was realised, in a sense, because he said last year, you know, Fabio's going to be a contender this year. And after those first 2 races, that proved the case. But then again, it happened something unexpected, is that we went to Brno and Fabio was nowhere. He was nowhere in Austria. And this is where we really started to see the struggles for Yamaha with this 2020 bike, was from Brno onwards. And again, how Fabio's championship collapsed was one of the most shocking things of 2020, I think, because it was just so dramatic.
Well, it was shocking, but at the same time, it was what we have seen with Yamaha riders last 3 years. So it's shocking, but only partially. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if we have to look the last 3-4 years, what was completely surprising or shocking was Fabio's performance. Because he was so stable, he was so consistent, he was really solid. And with Maverick and Valentino, we've seen a lot of ups and downs in the last years. In the end, that's what happened to Fabio as well. The only one keeping or being able to keep this consistency was Franco in the end, who competes with a different bike.
Yeah, and the bike more or less that Fabio rode in 2019. So in a way, Franco's 2020 was a bit like Fabio's in 2019, in that it was very consistent. And we know there was all these problems with the 2020 bike. Lynn Jarvis said in the team manager press conference in Portugal, you know, we've had these problems for a few years, which to me that's not really something you want to hear. The thing with Franco is he was just a better rider than all the other Yamaha riders this year. He was a better rider than most riders on the grid this year. So yes, the bike was maybe a bit more consistent, but Franco was the one who made the difference.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, Lynn Jarvis was the one saying that Maverick is a really particular rider. He's a very good rider, but he needs to have everything in place to give his best version. You know, you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now you can apply that to Fabio as well. I think there's something going on there in Yamaha which don't allow the riders to show their best version race after race.
And we know when this bike is perfect, when the conditions are perfect, we see how quick the Yamaha riders are. We saw that with Fabio, we saw that with Maverick this year, we've seen it obviously with Franco, but Franco was more consistent. So, but it is strange how these problems have persisted.
Yeah, the thing is that it's very difficult to have this kind of perfect conditions for your bike. Even Honda can say that. Even Suzuki can say that. No, if we have the perfect conditions, our bike is really fast. It's the best one. Yeah, of course. But you have to try to build a bike good enough for the different conditions that you're going to face during the year. And I think that's what Suzuki has done over the last, let's say, 2 years.
Suzuki, for me, sort of took over the mantle from Ducati from a few years ago, where the bike was generally quite consistently strong. At some tracks it was weak, but it was generally strong everywhere. And now Suzuki is sort of, they've got that right. And obviously that's what, along with Joan Mir, carried them to the championship. But you're right about Yamaha. This is, you can't have a bike that only works when things are perfect, because that happens very well, as we saw this year. It doesn't happen often. A big complaint from the riders was the engine. It wasn't powerful enough. It was, of course, unreliable. But Yamaha's philosophy has never been to build a powerful engine. So it almost seems like that's something that they should maybe not focus on as much. Well, of course, they can't next year. But, you know, the engine isn't the key problem. It's obviously the rest of the bike. There needs to be something done there.
Yeah, I mean, and don't forget that Yamaha has never been the most powerful bike of the grid, so they've been able to win a lot of titles with this kind of bike. So I think that they just need to come back to Yamaha's main philosophy and try to make it even better. So, I mean, that's what I mean, because in the end we all know which kind of bike the Honda is, we know which kind of bike the Suzuki is, and now we don't really know which kind of bike the Yamaha is, because they are focused, we need to get more power, more power, more power, more power, and then if you get more power, you probably will have some other problems in other areas, because in the end the perfect bike doesn't exist. So don't forget that Suzuki has won the title. And if you ask Mir and Rins, they say, no, we need more power. Yeah, of course, you need more power. But it's not that easy.
And we've seen that with, when you add power, the bike becomes, you know, Honda have had that over recently where they got more power to match Ducati, but the turning got worse. Ducati have always had this problem. I remember Wayne Rainey told me earlier this year that he remembers on his Yamaha at Hockenheim, he was 25 kilometres an hour slower than the Hondas, and which I must imagine would have made for a very difficult race around the old Hockenheim. But moving to, just to finish off on Yamaha, because we had this thing with the engine valves. We know that we've spoken about this a lot. It was a misunderstanding of the rules, but ultimately ultimately cost them the championship, because if it was an engine problem that hit Franco in Andalusia, and had he finished that race in the fourth place he would have been champion at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So it shows that there's a lot wrong with Yamaha, I think, right now. There's a lot that needs to be fixed.
Well, I think that what they need to fix the most is the communication between both, let's say, universes. I would say the Japanese and the European. In the end, the Yamaha Motor Racing and Yamaha Motor, you know, I mean the factory in Japan, and the guys running the MotoGP team based in Italy. So I think they need to have a better communication between them, because it's very difficult to understand what happened there with this misinterpretation of the regulations. I mean, if you have this rule, if you don't really understand or do a misinterpretation of this rule, you need to have a proper people who tells you, no, you're wrong. You have to follow this way, not this one. So in the end, that's what I think they need to improve. We've been asking to the riders a lot of times this year if don't they think that this is the missing part of this team. They never gave us a straight answer.
The one that was that was perhaps most critical was Rossi, because he said, look, the Japanese engineers, they take on our feedback, but
yeah,
they just do what they want. Yeah. And what was telling as well, as he said, what was perfect about Suzuki was the way that Davide Brivio was able to have that communication with Japan and with Italy, which is... So it's obvious that this has been a problem for a while that the Rossi's talked about.
Yeah, but in the end, even Davide, because don't forget that Davide was a key member of Yamaha at the beginning. He was the one convincing Rossi to go there and to accept the challenge. And he was a key member of that move, of that Yamaha recovery. And he told us that in the end, now, when he first joined Suzuki, he felt that the atmosphere in Suzuki was quite similar to the one he got when he first met Yamaha. Because the Japanese guys from, he said, if I'm not remember wrong, he said that the Suzuki Japanese team members trust on the European team. They are more open minded than the ones now running or fighting competing in Yamaha. So yeah, I think that's the main issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully when Cal Crutchlow comes in, I don't think communication will be an issue, especially when it comes to the problem with the bike.
For sure will be louder. I don't know if it will be more accurate, but for sure we will have louder screams.
Yeah, well, yeah, it'll certainly be a lot more sweary as well when it comes to feedback. Suzuki, of course, the first couple of rounds were really difficult. We thought when Mark was injured, we thought Suzuki would really step up, but Schwan crashed two out of the first three races. Alex was injured. And then they hit their stride from Bruno with Rins. He had that really good ride. But from there on, they hit their stride. Podiums, wins, so consistent, and it was what was going to win a championship this year was being smart, and Suzuki and Joan Mir were smart.
Even Joan accepts that he's not the fastest rider. He just says that he's probably was the one taking the most of the whole the all of the circumstances. He was the one able to get the most of the situation of this weird year that we've got in 2020. He was the most clever guy probably on the field, playing the game full gas when he was needed to do that. That's why he got this championship.
It was very Marc Marquez-esque in that sense, because that's how Mark has won championships. When he's been able to fight for the win, he's gone for it, and when he hasn't, he's seen the bigger picture. And obviously there was a lot of silly comments made, Mark's not here, the championship's devalued. If anything, the one who was most like Marc Marquez this year was Joan Mir,
I think, in a different, let's say, graduation, because we know that when Mark is 100% he's almost untouchable. Mir was lucky, he gave his best version, and in the end he played his cards in the best possible way. But he was lucky to get these ups and downs for the other riders. Otherwise, or whoever the champion would be, it's very difficult to find a season with so many different winners, with a rookie like Brad Binder, with so many satellite bikes, winning races, with a new, let's say, winning factory like KTM, with, so many different circumstances than play in the champion's role.
Mm-hmm. The fact that Suzuki was able to win a championship this year, that KTM could win races, so many satellite bikes were on the podium. I suppose what it really shows is that 2020 was Dorna's... This was what Dorna wanted. This is
the masterpiece.
Yeah. This was the end game of the rules. All the way back to 2012 when they brought the CRTs in, with the open class bikes. This was exactly what it was building towards. Look at all the riders that won races, all the different manufacturers, all the different teams. We will look at next year and think, well, this can happen again. KTM can win races again. Suzuki could win, you know, we've seen it can win a championship. People go, ah, well, Mark wasn't here, so this is what made 2020 so crazy and because the races were short. And yes, it played a part, but look at Formula One. It had a crazy schedule and the races still weren't as unpredictable as what they were in MotoGP. It just shows how competitive MotoGP is as a world
and
championship.
That's what Formula One is trying to change the rules for 2022. So they, in a different way, but they are trying to follow this way. And yeah, that's why I think that Dorna and especially Carmelo Ezpeleta has done a really, 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 really an amazing, outstanding job trying to because in the end, there's no single rider being able to say, listen, to complain about it. Because in the end, the rider still make the difference, but the difference is really small.
Yeah, look at the amount of practice sessions and qualifying that were covered 20 riders by under a second. That's unheard of at world championship level.
The best riders still are able to make the difference, but the difference between them is really small, and the difference between the bikes and the manufacturers is really small. Again, this year has been really different and really special because, as many riders say, if you have two consecutive races in the same racetrack, I mean, the ones struggling a bit more, they will have time enough to reduce the gap in the second race. So that's why most of the time we've seen more, let's say, tough fights in the second consecutive race at the same racetrack. But I think next year, if we have, let's say, a more normal, regular calendar, we will see a different scenario.
It's not fair to expect there to be 9 winners again next year, but the reality is that there could be, and that's the important part, I think, is that it can happen.
The good thing is that nobody can complain about this. The technical, let's say, direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think, obviously, the job Dorna and Urta and everyone did to get the championship going was amazing, but the fact that the championship we got was this one, it's just, you can't... And we're not, you know, we should hasten to add, we're not paid by Dorna or anything to say these things, but we cannot fault the job that they have done, that Carmelo has done, to make MotoGP happen in 2020, to make it what it is today. It's incredible.
Yeah, 100%.
Let's just finish on Suzuki because, you know, Joan Mir, we got this world champion, this guy in his second season, but what struck me about Joan winning the championship was just how nice a guy he is. He's not really a superstar, as it were. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't have a big social media presence. He doesn't show, you know, Instagram me shopping trips, and he's a nice, quiet guy, and that seems to be quite indicative of MotoGP riders coming up now anyway.
I think that it shows which kind of guy we are talking about, which kind of entourage he has around him, and I think it's really, really, let's say, I think the best, let's say, attribute or thing that you can say about a MotoGP rider is he's a normal guy. The one you can talk to him about bikes, or you can talk to him about any other stuff. So that's a huge thing, considering all the superstars we are having at this stage.
Yeah, absolutely. One rider that perhaps should have been a champion, should have really have won the championship this year based on what we've seen, was Andrea Dovizioso. This was the perfect opportunity, and it never worked out. Obviously, the Ducati had problems with this new rear tyre, but there was also problems within Ducati. The relationship between Dovi and particularly Gigi Deligno soured a lot, and I think that obviously contributed to what we saw this year as well, is that there just wasn't the love there that you're needed to have a championship challenging team?
Yeah, we've seen, a poor version of Dovi this year, because we've seen a really good Pecco Bagnaia at the beginning. We've seen a quite solid Jack Miller, but we haven't seen Andrea. Only, we've seen him once, and that's all we've seen from him. I mean, he's never been. I was looking at the data, and he's never been the first Ducati in qualifying. Never.
Wow, that's a stat and a half.
So this year, never he's been the first Ducati in qualifying. It's a bit. He's only been 5 times the first Ducati in FP1. Only 1 time the first Ducati in FP2. Only 2 times the first Ducati in FP3. 5 times the first Ducati in FP4, and 0 times the first Ducati in qualifying. We all were expecting a bit more for him, especially more. I mean, in a year where the consistency was the key factor, we were expecting much more from, the most consistent rider in the last 4 years.
Again, that was another one of the big surprises of this year, was just how inconsistent Dovi was. And again, we know his main problem was this tyre, and it affected a lot of riders as well. But the way the situation with Dovi and Ducati kind of went is, it's an interesting one for me, because yes, the Jack Miller was good this year. Pecco Bagnaia is obviously, he's got the talent to be a future great, but would I have gotten rid of Dovizioso for at least the next 2 years? I'm not sure Ducati was the best decision.
Well, yeah, but in the end, I think that something happened, and not even this year. I think last year, with all what happened with Lorenzo, Gigi, and Gigi trying to convince Lorenzo to come back, to put pressure on Dovi. In the end, it's very difficult to manage MotoGP. I mean, let's say, From my side, and I can be wrong, but from my side, I wouldn't say that this is the most clever move to put pressure on your main asset or your main rider for your title hopes, to put pressure on him, trying to, sign another rider just to put pressure on him. I wouldn't say that this is a really, really, really clever move, because in the end, that's what Dovi thought. Okay, you're playing this game. Okay, I'm out.
Dovi still hasn't said anything about what really happened. He refuses to, because he's too nice a guy. What struck me was after Portugal, when he said, I was happier with my achievements at Ducati than some other people.
I wouldn't say that he hasn't spoken clear yet. Not because he is a nice guy or he is not a nice guy. It's just because he is still under contract.
Yeah, there is that too. But then again, it hasn't stopped some other riders.
We're going to hear from him. Yeah. No worries.
Yeah,
we're going to hear from Dovi. We're going to hear his version of the situation.
Yeah,
because he really, really, really want to do to say what he has to say, but he's under contract, so he doesn't want to get fined or
It's interesting that he did dodge those questions. He let little things slip, like I said there about he felt people weren't celebrating his achievements enough in Ducati. I think we know who. You do have to credit him for, even though he was under contract, because he could have said anything he wanted, really, if he was really that pissed off about the situation, I'm sure he would have let rip. But it shows how mature he is as a rider and professional he is, that there was a job still to do. Do you really think it was all about money?
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that he's not a...
I don't know, for sure. I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying that he's only... But it played a huge role, because he's going to give us his version, 100% sure about that. When the contract expires.
Yeah. I hope he gives us his version. I wouldn't drink too much on New Year's Eve because you never know, we might start talking on the 1st of January. He might have a lot to get off his chest.
Yeah. And then you would say, yeah, no, he's a true gentleman. He's a true gentleman. He never said any bad word about Ducati. And then January the 1st, boom.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think if it's going to say a bad word about it, I don't think it'll be Ducati as such. I think it'll be certain people within Ducati.
Yeah, probably.
And I think we know who his crosshairs will be over. Let's just wrap up here. We saw the future, I think, of MotoGP with Brad Binder, with Miguel Oliveira, with KTM. That looks to me like it's going to be an extremely, extremely strong force in the next couple of seasons.
I can't wait to see what's next step of KTM, because I think that we're going to have a new bike next year with new engine, which they will be the only one with Aprilia, of course, but because of the concessions. But no, KTM will be the only non-concession team putting a completely new bike and new engine on track. So yeah, I'm pretty excited to see what's next for KTM. I don't think, to be honest, I don't expect much more from Brad or Miguel, because we have seen a lot from them even this year. So if they keep following the same performance, we're gonna I think they're gonna be fighting for really, really important things next year.
An interesting storyline for me next year will be Paul Espargaró at Honda, of course. Mm-hmm. So instrumental of the success at KTM. He takes on probably his biggest challenge, particularly after this year with what we saw with Honda. It looks like he's going to go to a bike that's not as bad as it was at the start of this season, which is testament to Honda's work, and of course to Taka and to Alex Marquez as well for working with the team and helping turn that bike around a little bit.
I really think that Paul is really, really brave to take this challenge.
Mm.
And I think it talks a lot from him, which kind of guy and which kind of rider he is, because he's accepting this challenge, which is really, really, really difficult and challenging for him. Now he was in the Spanish podcast 2 weeks ago, and he told us, listen, I have some doubt about it, of course, because in the end, some days I say, oh, what have I done? I will have to start from zero again, knowing new people, knowing new ways to work, of course, new bike. But some other times I say, no, listen, this is HRC, this is my dream. I mean, being able to jump into this bike, which is a winning bike. Well, KTM now is a winning bike as well. But at that point, when he had the offer from HRC, I'm not blaming him for taking the decision opposite. I'm really... admire him for having for being brave enough to take that challenge.
Yeah, I spoke to him in Portugal. Well, I spoke to him on Zoom on the Portugal weekend. I wasn't in Portugal. And he said to me, look, as an athlete, you wanted to push yourself and you want to take on the challenge. And this is, he said to me, he's going to Honda not to prove a point to anyone. He just wants to prove to himself that if he can be quick on a Honda, then it proves he's a top rider in MotoGP. And that's, again, I thought that was quite a telling comment. It speaks to his character as a rider and as a person as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's good because he shows respect, but he doesn't show fear, which is good.
Yeah.
So he's not scared, but he has a lot of respect for this challenge, you know what I mean? Which I think that is the correct balance for a challenge of this size.
Yeah, of course, we don't know what's going to happen with Mark yet. We think he might be out for the first half of 2021, perhaps up until May at least, after his third surgery. But he will have another Marquez to keep an eye on, because Alex came on really, really strong this year. And I think Alex really, really surprised a lot of people, just how well he did. I mean, it was a difficult situation he came into,
I mean, at the beginning of the year, I mean, after Mark's crash injury, if somebody asked us who will be the only on the rider being able to jump into the podium, we wouldn't say Alex.
Yeah, for sure.
And he did it twice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And in two very different circumstances as well.
Yeah, of course. Le Mans was in wet conditions, when you can say, well, yes, but this is the first, as we always say, no, this is a wet podium, it's a different, okay. But week after, boom, in Aragon.
Yeah, he fought for the win, and he was there the whole race.
Exactly. So, and week after, he was really close to, and when he crashed, he was doing this comeback, and he was really fighting for podium positions when he crashed. So, yeah, I think next year, without being in the focus of, you know, HRC, Repsol, blah, 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 I think he will be able to, yeah, to work with less pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think he can, yeah, give us a few surprises.
Yeah, I think if there's going to be, I think Honda are on the right track to next year too, with either Alex or Paul, and maybe even Taka as well, until we know what happens with Mark, to finally win again, because, of course, they haven't... This is their first winless season since they came back to the Premier Class in 1982, which is quite incredible. But Alex looks like he's... It's not so much that he looks like it, he sounds like a rider that's ready to win in MotoGP. He sounds like he's...
Yeah, especially in this MotoGP.
Honda have really, I think people were critical of the move to begin with, but Honda knew what they were doing with Alex. They knew exactly what they were doing. Just to end on a nice note, I just wanted to get, because it's been a crazy season, it's been probably the toughest season I think any of us have had to do. But what was your highlight of this crazy 2020 season?
In a way, I would say Mark's comeback just before the crash was one of the most powerful exhibitions I've ever seen in MotoGP.
For me, if I was to pick a moment, I would maybe pick Bruno and Brad Binder's win, because it was unexpected. But more for the fact that the week after was, I think, one of the busiest weeks we had on Autosport and Motorsport.com with everything that we wrote. You know, day after day, it was feature, you know, press conference with Pit Biro, stories from that. And that was, to me, really enjoyable, just because we had this crazy moment and then we had so much to do after it. And then we get to the next race and it was completely different. We had Dovi. And so I think I think for me, that week was maybe one of the best ones.
Fair enough.
But it's been, I have to say, it's been an incredible season. And for my first year as well with Autosport, it's been a privilege to work with you as well, Yuri, and to learn everything from you. And you know,
likewise,
you've helped me a lot this year, and hopefully we can have a normal season next year where we're in the paddock and not
A bit more normal would be good.
Yeah, absolutely. That is us for 2020. We're going to go and have a Christmas break now and sleep for about 2 weeks until the new year. Thank you ever so much to the listeners for your company this year. We know it's been tough for everyone, but we hope that we gave you a little bit of enjoyment during the weeks during this year with MotoGP podcasts and all of the stuff we wrote on Autosport and Motorsport.com, which you can go and read now. We've still got a lot of stuff to come over the next few weeks before the new year. Thank you very much for your company. Have a lovely Christmas, have a lovely new year, and keep looking after yourselves.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.